Pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Australian Senate, you're listening to news, views and opinions on events from here at home and around the globe on politics, business and society in general. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Welcome back, dear listener. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove. We're up to episode 52. With me is the Velvet Glove, probably licking his wounds a little bit. Scott, have you picked yourself up off the floor?
I have picked myself up off the floor, yes. It was a little disappointing, but, you know, you get that.
It was disappointing, Scott. Yeah, I'm disappointed, so...
I don't think we ever realised. We knew we were never going to win.
Yes. We were hoping we might do a bit better.
I think we were hoping we'd do a little better, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, what are the latest numbers?
Well, all I've got is a printout from sort of 2 days ago, which it seems that the Electoral Commission just stopped voting for 2 days anyway. So the ones I've got are probably pretty close to the latest figures. But, Scott, we had, last count, had 2,560 first, you know, number one votes for the Secular Party. And that's almost exactly where we were last year. So, see, I can understand, like, we, you know, in terms of leaflet dropping and stuff like that, I recognise we wouldn't have done any more than what was done last election. I wasn't actually a member of last election, so I'm not exactly sure what was done. But you know, we've had a pretty powerful Facebook page for 12 months, doing all sorts of stuff on there, like really, really good Facebook page. And I would have hoped that that would have created just, you know, 10 or 20% increase in the votes, but it doesn't seem to have.
No.
So, dear listener, we ranked about 32 out of 37 parties, which is terrible. So I've got a few theories that I'm going to expand upon, Scott.
Okay.
Well, we need to
hit me with them.
Well, we need to look at who did quite well in the election and sort of compare them to us and extrapolate some theories from that. So I'm
right
going to, I'm going to start, and some feedback that we've got as well. So one item of feedback that I've had from friends is just the name Secular Party doesn't mean anything to most people. So you and I know what secular means, but you must admit that when you say to people, "I'm a member of the Secular Party," they would say to you, "Well, what's that about?" Would they, most of the time?
No, most of them are. Most of my friends understand what the word secular means,
all
but
right.
Yeah.
Well, maybe my friends.
It's not an uncommon complaint, though.
Yeah.
It does actually happen from time to time.
Maybe my friends were speaking on behalf of the average Joe. So here's one thing I notice when I look at the list of parties who've done, you know, okay-ish. And so we got 2,500 votes and we've come in 32nd. Somebody like the Animal Justice Party has got 18,000 votes and they've come in 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. They come in 10th place. The Animal Justice Party, and about 4 or 5 beneath them is the Australian Cyclist Party, with 10,721, and in particular with the Australian Cyclist Party, Scott, I've got a theory that people just walk into the voting room and they open up their ballot sheet, and there's a new type of donkey voter. Is what I'm going to say, who, you know, got a bit of an idea of who they're going to vote for, but not a great, perhaps. And rather than just marking number one, they will just look at the names and rely on the description of the party name and think whether that matches up with their, you know, something they identify with. And I think just... because I don't reckon the Australian Cyclist Party have been out and about campaigning, leafleting, putting up billboard signs, you know, any more than we have. But people got into the polling booth and saw Australian Cyclist Party and thought, actually, I quite like riding my bike. I'd like to have things that help bike riding. I'm going to give them a vote. And lo and behold, they get 10,000 votes. Like, am I oversimplifying it or not?
No, it sounds reasonable.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you got... If someone did some sort of behavioural study on voters, you'd probably find that there's a reason for that being garbage, but it's also a possibility that it's true.
I'm a little bit the same with Animal Justice Party. Like, I've never heard anything about the Animal Justice Party in the last 2.5 years while I've been paying attention. No signs, no billboards, no leaflets, nobody in the media talking, and... You know, they get 18,000 votes for Animal Justice Party. Because, see, you know, in the wash up, dear listener, you know, in the secular party on our email list, you know, there's all sorts of talk back and forward about what happened and various theories. And some people are saying, like, well, we need, you know, a charismatic leader who can get into the media, and, or we need, you know, more money so we can do more media stuff and blah, blah. And I was simply just making the point in these discussions that the Australian Cyclists and the Animal Justice Party didn't do any of that. I mean, their marketing is as miserable as ours, yet they've ended up with, you know, well, in the case of the Animal Justice Party, 18,000 votes compared to ours 2.5, and the Cyclists, 10,000. So I think there's a lot, Scott, to be said for having a descriptive name that people can actually identify with and say, oh, I'm in favour of that sort of thing. So, you're not with me on that, or you don't think so?
I feel for some time that the name doesn't help.
Hmm.
I wasn't entirely sure what to change the name to.
That's the hard part.
It is a hard part because... you know, it was pointed out on the email group this afternoon that if you change the party's name too much, you've got to go and get new, you've got to start the thing again and that sort of stuff.
I don't know if that's true.
Well, we don't know if that's true, that's for sure. But there's some talk around that sort of thing that needs to be... Well, we need to find that out for starters, you know. And then, you know, should we merge with some of the other parties that are around the place? I'm not convinced that's the right way forward either, because secularism is something that is very important. And I don't think we want to throw that baby out with the bathwater.
I agree.
But it is something we've got to think about. Yeah.
Added to my argument, Scott, if we look at the five parties that did worse than us, two of them have got really bad names. One's called Citizens Electoral Council. So you would look at that and you would go, well, I have no idea what they're on about, Citizens Electoral Council. Turns out they think global warming is a fraud, and so that's their sort of thing. Which, if you had that opinion, you could have just voted for Pauline Hanson.
Exactly.
But, you know, but Citizens Electoral Council, kind of three meaningless sort of names or words that you really wouldn't know what they're about. And another one was called voteflux.org/upgrade democracy. So, again, you know, who knows what that means. So, then there was Veterans Party, Country Minded and Socialist Equality Party. So I reckon that some of the worst performing parties were ones who had just names that didn't resonate with people, where they couldn't do a donkey vote of, you know, Health Australia Party. These are anti-vaccinators, Scott, and they got 5,700. They got twice as many as us. Because people
That's a little bit of a slap in the face, isn't it?
Yeah. So people are more concerned with it, you know, more pro anti-vaccination than they are, you know, controlling madcap religions. So that's my sort of first take from it is, I mean, you can't blame everything on the name. but you know, if we'd have got sort of 10,000 to 15,000, we would have been quite happy with that. And
yeah, absolutely.
I'm just working on a theory that perhaps with a better name, you never know, we might have just, because I just think there's some easy votes in here where people don't really think too hard about who they're voting for. I mean, that
would only work if you're, say we got the third position again, then that would work then, I think, that if you had a more user-friendly name, shall we say.
Yeah, but I don't even know if that's the case, because a friend of mine said, like, by the time you've spread it out on your little table in your voting booth, that big sheet of paper, you're looking at the middle names before you look anywhere else. Like, I had a friend who was looking for my name, and he spread the thing out, and just the mechanics of it mean that you actually probably start in the middle and start working your way out from the middle than left to right when it's such a big sheet of paper in such a cramped, situation. So I reckon I'm saying there's a new donkey voter, Scott, who doesn't go from left to right, but who just looks at the names and goes, well, Health Party must be about health, Mature Australia must be about mature people, Sustainable Australia about sustainable energy. So but it's tricky to come up with a name that encompasses secularism that isn't the word secular, because there's not a lot of alternative words.
There's not really, is there?
So anyway, there you go, dear listener. It was a bit miserable. So we're licking our wounds and just wondering what we're doing and what we should be doing and all the rest of it. Understandably, I think. I mean,
And if you want us to keep going, dear listener, then there's a meeting coming up on the 17th of July.
Yes.
So you can come on down to the Brisbane Library and get involved.
Yes.
We do need more people involved. I think that's what it comes down to, is that, it was also very easy for one bloke to write an email this afternoon, and I'm not sure whether or not he listens to this podcast, so I won't mention his name, but and I thought to myself, were you out? Were you out distributing leaflets? Were you out waving flags and all that sort of stuff? And we do need people out on the beat next time round, ladies and gentlemen. So,
Anyway. And ideas and all the rest of it. So there's meetings in Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria, which you can find on the Secular Party website. And if you've got something to say, you could rock up and give your 2 cents worth. So, speaking from the Brisbane point of view, we'd love to see you and hear what you've got to say.
Exactly.
So, Scott, that's enough about us and our miserable performance. But
let's go on to someone else's miserable performance.
Well, the election generally. Like, people, we've got to give a bit of a recap and a review of the actual election result, excluding ours. And
exactly. And we still have not handed over a six-pack of beer.
No, it's still up for grabs.
Because it's still up for grabs, yes. You don't really know who's got to win it. Although I was a little bit heartened this afternoon when I was riding home. They reported on the ABC that Anthony Green had given the coalition 73 seats and said it was a possibility they could get to 76.
Seems more likely than it was 24 hours ago.
Exactly. That old adage that the coalition wins the postal vote appears to be coming true.
But Scott, I'm looking at the Queensland Senate because that's the one that sort of interested me. And for the rest of Australia, on behalf of the Queensland population, I apologise that we've elected Pauline Hanson once again. We've inflicted her on the nation.
We do apologise, ladies and gentlemen, to our southern listeners. We do apologise.
Scott, she polled more than the Greens. Like, she got 133,000 and the Greens got 110.
Yeah.
So the Greens are actually relying on preferences to get their Senate spot.
Yeah.
So that's you know, that's interesting about Pauline Hanson, that whole sort of thing going on there.
Yeah, and the thing with her is that she didn't really... I mean, apparently she had some... she had some time on breakfast television, and I don't watch breakfast television. I've got to admit, I couldn't comment on that. But she didn't really have the airplay she'd got last time.
No.
And I thought that... and this is something that Howard suggested, that if you ignore her, she'll go away. If you deprive her of oxygen, she'll stop breathing.
Mm.
And, you know, I really thought that that's what we were doing. We were depriving her of oxygen and letting her, you know, gasp for her last breath. But she's just come back out of the blue, really? Well, yep. It appears that she's come out of the blue. Well, but she clearly hasn't come out of the blue. She's come out from somewhere.
Well, she's such a strong brand that people just know who she is. And when she announces she's running, then people know who she is and what she stands for. And... so in credit to her for her marketing and branding, that people know what she's on about or think they do. So she did amazingly well, like 133,000.
Yeah.
So
yeah. She
might get two Senate people.
I know. That's really frightening that she ends up with two. Yeah.
Mm. So that's kind of heartening to some extent, Scott, like in our miserable performance that we can go, well, my God, like... what sort of electorate was this when Pauline Hanson could come in third place? Maybe it's in that sort of voting environment a credit to you if you score down the bottom. Who knows? But I read Paul Sivret in the Courier Mail is one of the very few Courier Mail columnists who actually comes out with sensible stuff. And he made the point that in this election, with the number of people who have left the major parties and have voted for someone other than Liberal National or the Labor Party. And he said that kind of on the left side of politics, the Greens and the Sex Party and other sort of minor ones are picking up a younger, progressive demographic exasperated at the slow pace of reform in areas such as marriage equality, clean energy or drug law reform. So for those younger people, change is not happening fast enough.
Mm.
And then on the other end of the scale, One Nation, with Pauline Hanson, is picking up people driven by the reverse, people who have a fear of change and a sense of disenfranchisement. I think he's spot on there.
I think he's dead right about that. I mean, like, certainly she does appeal to... you know, that demographic who are generally white middle class or former middle class men.
Yep.
You know, the men that used to work in the factories and that sort of stuff.
Wanting a return to the good old days.
Exactly. You know, where you spend a year's salary buying a fridge, you know, that sort of thing, you know.
Mm.
It's really crazy that people do look back on the good old days and they do want to go back to the good old days because, you know, frankly, the good old days didn't exist. You know?
Yeah, it wasn't as good.
No, they weren't as good, no.
So anyway, I thought that was an interesting way of looking at it. People leaving the major parties, on the one hand, because they're not changing enough, and on the other hand, they're changing too much. And first group ending up with the Greens and the Sex Party and the like, and the other group ending up with Pauline Hanson, or perhaps ending up with some of these Christian groups, Scott, like Family... Gee, there's a lot of Christian groups in the Senate, like Family
there
First.
Is. Family First, the Australian Christians, or Christian yeah. Democratic Party, the Australian Christians, and there was a third one, wasn't there?
Democratic Labor Party would be sort of
another one.
A Labor version of Christians. So... there's a few of them there, and they've done reasonably well. Family First came in sixth place. So, interestingly, they didn't do as well in places where Pauline Hanson did well. So Pauline Hanson and Family and these sort of right-wing religious groups are sort of farming the same sort of territory, and where she did well, they did not. So that was interesting.
Mm.
Um, So that's an interesting way of looking at the result in that the left going for... But, you know, the Greens only picked up marginally in the Senate here. So, I mean, for all the efforts the Greens do when they're high profile and the fact they've already got members of Parliament, they've still only got one Senate person, looks like, in Queensland. So... It's a struggle even for a well-organised, biggish party like the Greens, hey, Scott?
It is a struggle for them, yeah, for sure.
Mm. Yeah. So that's the Senate sort of as we speak in Queensland at least, and the rest of the country kind of is going along the same lines. So I've got an article here, Federal Election 2016, where Pauline Hanson's support comes from, and makes the point that she outpolled the Greens. And she did well in strong traditional National Party territories.
And that's no change from last time. She did well in those National Party areas. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she's... She has done quite well. Where are we? Yeah. Southwest of Ipswich, Maranoa, Western Downs are all strong traditional National Party territories. The electorates are right, covering the Lockyer Valley, 21%. Hinkler based on Bundaberg, 19.6%. Flynn, south and west of Gladstone, nearly 17%. The Wide Bay covering Mirrabarra, nearly 15%. God alone knows what these people want the National Party to do, but I find it incredible that they've thrown away the Nationals and they've gone for someone completely out of the loop like Pauline Hanson.
So I reckon to some extent these people are not quite rural in that they're not genuine farmers, but they might be sort of manufacturing, you know, small manufacturing or, you know... Gladstone, for example, would have been a lot of sort of manufacturing jobs that have disappeared with the downturn now in the mining industry, and Townsville with the nickel refinery, and kind of areas that aren't city, but they're not true rural, because I think the true rural people will go, like the Nationals will sort of look after farmers, but if you don't have a big paddock and some cows and crops... You know, they'll sell you out in free trade agreements and things. So I think that sort of regional, rural person who's not a farmer, who might have voted Nationals previously, turns to Pauline Hanson at this time. So, and Barnaby Joyce... had to be stuck in his own electorate, you know, campaigning heavily. He couldn't get out and about because
Had to really that is very true. He
hang on to his seat.
That's a very good point. Actually, I hadn't considered that. Is that Joyce was tied to his own electorate?
Scott, I gave a little. You came over to my place on the night of the election, and we had a few other people with
secular
us.
Secular party members.
Yeah. Yes. And I gave a quick quiz, and the question was, and I'll give it to you now, dear listener, is which party was listed in the preferences for both the LNP and the Labor Party? And think quickly, because I'm about to give the answer, but the answer was Katter's Australia Party. Like, he managed to get on the list for both of those.
Yeah, which I found really bizarre that, I mean, let's face it, the two majors aren't going to be distributing their preferences, you know, they are, well, hang on a minute.
Well, yes, the surplus will.
The surplus will, yes, that's a good point. Yeah, good
point. So, you know, after, let me just go back here, but looks like Liberals will get 4 and Labor will get 3, and then they'll have a surplus to be, you know, preferenced out, so... So anyway, Bob Katter, amazing. He actually pulled off the trifecta. Because not only did he get on the preferences for Labor and Liberals, but he also was on the preferences for Pauline Hanson. So say what you like about Bob Catter, but he knows how to get, you know, he knows how to get preferenced in these Senate deals, doesn't he? So,
yeah, he does.
I'll have to get hold of his and see who he preferenced. But that's amazing ability by Bob Catter to get on the card of the Senate for Liberals, the LNP, Labor, and Pauline Hanson. So,
yeah.
Congratulations to him on that. The Iron Fist, the Velvet Glove, and the 12th Man are all members of the Secular Party. There may be other contributors to the show who are also members. That does not mean that every opinion given on this show is policy of the Secular Party. To find out what is policy, go to the website of the Secular Party. And while you're there, think about joining and signing up, because we need more secularists in this world. Thanks. Scott, there's a lot of talk now about Malcolm Turnbull and his performance. What did you think?
I didn't have a problem with Malcolm's performance up until his speech at 12:15 that night.
Mm.
And at that point, and I only saw it the next morning because I'd gone to bed by then, but the next morning I saw it on ABC and I thought to myself, whoa, he has not, you know, come any distance from that Republican referendum when he lost. You know, mm-hmm. It was quite a churlish response. And he threw everything. He threw everything to the wind. He didn't mention the candidates who lost, and he had to come out the next day or the day after and face the press and give the speech he should have given on Saturday night. His performance wasn't all that good. We've he's got in a something here from the conversation. Yeah, go on.
He's in a bit of trouble, isn't he? So there's all sorts of murmurings in the party. And
But, you know, they can be sheeted home to Corey Bernardi. And, you know, there was a article I was reading before we started here tonight that was from the Sydney Morning Herald, and they were suggesting that Corey Bernardi was in talks to splinter off the Conservatives away from the Liberal Party.
Mm.
Now, if Corey Bernardi does that, he will be finished, and you might actually then end up with the Liberal Party back being the Liberal Party. But I find it bizarre that it was being discussed openly like that.
Mm.
Because if you look at where Turnbull came unstuck, if Turnbull had his time over again, the thing he should have done was he should have called an election fairly promptly after he was elected to the leadership. He should have said, you know, I've got to get my own mandate, I've got to do this, I want to clear the decks and have an election and move on.
Yeah, he should have. Yep.
He should have. If he'd done that, he would have been returned very comfortably. He would have had an increase in the small L Liberals within the coalition party room, so the capital C Conservatives would have to shut up. And he could have pushed marriage equality through the parliament rather than having to go down the road of this bloody plebiscite.
The other big mistake he made was he called a double dissolution. Like,
exactly, yeah. That was madness, going to double dissolution. It really was. I mean, and that is why Pauline's now looking at getting two senators up here in Queensland.
Yeah. So just the maths of it were crazy, and he didn't have a piece of legislation that was that important that required a double dissolution. So that was just pathetic politics on his part. In calling a double dissolution, like, just a bad mistake. So
it was a bad mistake, yeah.
Actually, I'm going to skip to a quote from an article from The Conversation about Turnbull, and I really liked this paragraph in it, which said, "The question is, how can someone who has had designs on becoming Prime Minister for decades, a man of commercial and academic accomplishment, with friends and connections in all corners of power in the land, well-read, well-informed, long untroubled by the need to make any more money, keep making so many unnecessary mistakes. It's true.
It is true. You know, it is really unfortunate because he did shoot himself in the foot with this one. He really did. And, you know, unfortunately for him, the Conservatives are now going to be emboldened.
Yeah.
And if he'd gone to the election earlier and he would have won and he would have ended up with more small L Liberals in the party room, then he could have just shoved through the agenda that he wanted.
Yeah. The interesting...
We would have had a market price on carbon, all that sort of stuff by now. Yeah.
Mm. So two commentators. Well, Andrew Bolt is just incensed. Like, he just keeps accusing Turnbull of having stabbed Tony Abbott in the back, and also Peter Credlin, you know, Abbott's former advisor, now commentator, saying the same thing about how if Tony Abbott had been in charge, then the Liberal Nationals would be luxuriating in an enormous victory right now.
Yeah, that is garbage, isn't it?
Well,
it really is garbage. I mean, if Abbott was still in charge, they would be on the opposition benches by now.
Here's a statistic I was given, which I haven't had a chance to check on the AEC, but it was sort of through Facebook from somebody who said that the swing against the Liberal Party throughout the country as a whole was 3.6%.
Yeah.
The swing against Malcolm Turnbull in his own seat was 2.7%. The swing against Tony Abbott in his seat was 9%. So to the people who think that had you stuck with Tony Abbott, the Liberals would be just as happy as pigs in mud right now, he lost 9% in his own seat.
In seat, yeah. And that was a safe Liberal seat too. So,
yep.
You know, to suggest that... that it would have been better with Abbott at the helm is nonsense. It really is garbage.
Yeah. So there's the answer for that argument. If you're an Abbott supporter out there, a 9% swing against him in his own electorate, you know, for goodness sake, you can't possibly maintain an argument that things would have been better under Tony Abbott. So
no, that's right. Yeah.
Mm, so that was that. Scott... I have something from, the Essential Report, already coming out with who would you vote for in the next election. This is amazing, isn't it? Like, 5th of
July.
We've
only just finished one election.
I know. Barely 72 hours after an election, and they're already polling people. Which one would you vote for?
It's going to be 50-50, isn't it?
Yeah. So, that's a 12th man like performance, Scott. Exactly right, 50-50. Here's the bit, here's part of the other things that were more interesting in this one, was when did you make your decision about which party to vote for in the federal election? And the first option is more than 4 weeks before the election, 2 to 4 weeks before the election, in the last week before the election, the day before the election, the day of the election, before I went to vote, when I got to the polling booth, and don't know. And, you're probably not surprised to know, Scott, that the biggest one was for the first one. So 54% of people said that they had made their decision more than 4 weeks before the election. 2 to 4 weeks before the election was 15%. In the last week, 14%. The day before the election, 4%. The day of the election, 3%. And in the actual polling booth, 4%. So maybe that goes against my theory about a clear-cut name and people just choosing it in the booth, if only 4% voted in the actual polling booth.
Well, I was amongst those of the 4% that made up my mind on the day.
Right.
When I arrived there, really.
Right.
I,
This is for your votes after the secular party, I'm hoping.
With the secular party, they were getting the first preference, but it was what I was going to do with the number six preference, where it was of interest to me. And I eventually went to the Labor Party rather than the coalition, and it
Good
was very difficult for me, but it was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
But it did hurt quite a lot when I did that, but anyway,
To console myself with my theory, as I look at these figures, they've split up the voters between Labor, Liberal National, Greens and others. And for people who voted other, 10% of them voted that way decided when they got into the polling booth. So,
you're saying that of those people who were going to vote other, then...
Yes, 10% of them.
10% made up their mind that day.
Yes, yeah. So that's a significant number. And there's a 9% don't know. And I reckon there's a hell of a lot who might have known who they were voting for in the first couple, but then after that it was just going to be just rattling through the pages and ticking off names that were half appealing to them. So
That really wouldn't surprise me.
So that was the essential report, already up and away. Scott, Pauline Hanson, a couple of things. A couple of her, I went and looked at her policies. She's in favour of same-sex marriage.
That's she good. Is?
Hmm.
Oh, really?
Yep. Well, she says, her policy is, Australians should have the right to vote in a referendum to define marriage as being between a heterosexual couple or a same-sex couple. Oh, so maybe she's not. Well, maybe she's just happy to go with whatever it says.
You know, Ashby, the bloke that got done with Peter Slipper.
Yeah.
You know, he's a homosexual, and he's been senior in her staff now.
Yes, he is.
So, yeah.
It also goes on the policy to say, we also acknowledge that same-sex couples living in de facto relationships should be afforded the same property rights as heterosexual couples. So I think it seems to me that they're pro marriage equality and
handsome party. Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me.
One that I liked here was we will revitalise our manufacturing and trade industries, blah, 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 and leave the Trans-Pacific Partnership if it proves to be detrimental to Australia. Well, we haven't even entered it yet. We haven't. So she seems to be, you know, leaning towards anti-TPP, so that's good. Firearms, she actually just wants to uphold the current laws. So,
well, she does she?
A bit worried about her and drug law reform. She wants to build rehab facilities for addicted drug users, but she wants treatment to be paid for by patients and not taxpayers. How's that going to work?
For God's sake, I mean... building rehab and that sort of stuff and getting people into rehab is great, but you can't expect someone that's got an addiction to heroin to pay for it themselves.
Exactly. You know? Yep. And then there's a whole bunch of other ones which are, some of them are a bit, she's quite clever in her wording on some of this. It's kind of hard to know where she stands, but of course, her main one would be zero net immigration and not going to build any more mosques and clearly extremely anti-Islam. So that's Pauline Hanson. But you never know, Scott, with your same-sex marriage, might be some good news there. And
she's certainly in favour of a plebiscite.
Hmm.
You know, so... you know, assuming Turnbull does get to 76 in the House, then he shouldn't have too many problems getting it through the Senate, I would have thought.
Hmm. And I'm starting to relax that we will never have a TPP, a Trans-Pacific Partnership, because Labor's not going to allow it, and these guys who are in, like Xenophon and people like that, are kind of a protectionist sort of mindset, so and Pauline Hanson, so, and Katter, so... I don't think a TPP is going to get up. I think that one... and then again, in the USA as well, both Hillary Clinton and Trump, are both saying that they don't like these free trade agreements. So for all the time spent negotiating that one, it looks like it'll never get up, Scott, I think.
Yeah, it's a pity. I mean, like, the whole idea of getting more trade and that sort of stuff is a good idea. It really is good. But you've got to then remove from that those bloody... What's the word I'm groping for? You know, the legal agreements with dispute clauses. You've got to get rid of those. If you get rid of those, if you get them out of your trade agreements, then you can actually argue that you got a reasonable trade agreement. But
Scott, when you were at the polling booth, did you see Get Up at all with their orange shirts?
No, I didn't see them. No.
See, I had them at my polling booth, and I said to them, like, what's Get Up? Who are you people? And the guy explained it to me that Get Up is an organisation. They're not a political party, but they've got lots of workers and volunteers, and they poll people as to what are the important issues, and then they analyse the parties as to what they stand for. And then they get their workers to go out and campaign for the people who best support the policies. So they handed me their brochure, and at the last election, they had decided that the Great Barrier Reef was their thing that people were most concerned with, and therefore you should vote either Labor, Xenophon, Lazarus or Greens. And I just find this the strangest thing that they could get lots of people to volunteer, because next election they could poll people and come up with something quite different. And how you can get people motivated to work for you when they don't even know what the subject will be just amazes me. I don't know how they do it.
Well, They probably get their people to get involved once they've got the thing that they've got organised, you know?
Yeah, but just getting people to sign up and be a member of GetUp, and you'd be like, well, what are we going to be doing with, you know, in 2 years' time? You'd say, well, I don't know, it depends on what people vote for. Like, that would be, I just don't know how they do it. So anyway, Scott, that's election wrap-up for 2016, and we shall leave the election discussion for a bit and move on to more of our general what's happening with religion, secularism and stuff in Australia and around the world for a bit of the remainder of the podcast. So, Scott, interesting article. It's possible that I am possessed by a demon, according to this article.
Why? Have you suddenly spoken in foreign languages that you've never learned?
Well, you know, I'm not showing a lot of the signs, but I'm starting to head down the track because there was an article, dear listener, which I came across in a Facebook feed or something like that, which here was the headline. Here are four signs that you might be demonically possessed, according to a Catholic psychiatrist. And when I saw that headline, you know, well, I can't remember exactly when I saw it, but I probably nearly wet myself with excitement thinking that that there is podcast material before I even read the article. And the four signs that you're demonically possessed. One,
a person can suddenly speak in a foreign language that they've never learned.
I can't do that.
You can't do that, right?
No.
Two, a person develops superior strength and in rare cases might have the powers of levitation.
I don't think I can do that. Skip to number four, Scott.
Number four, a person has detailed knowledge about strangers' history and their most shameful secrets.
I don't know that I've got that either.
Right. Okay, well, three, a person starts saying unusually venomous things about religion.
There you go. That's the one.
Well, that's it.
I've started on a slippery slope and, you know, one down, three to go, I think.
Well, yeah, I don't think you're possessed, but, you know.
No, I'm not yet, but I think Lucifer is sort of tugging at my collar and and looking for an opening to invade my body. So under that heading it says, sure, lots of people dislike religion, but the sort of thing we're talking about here is like that scene in The Exorcist where Linda Blair stabbed herself repeatedly in the crotch with a crucifix. Even the most diehard atheists usually aren't that antagonistic towards religion. Scott, normally I'm not. Sure, I would say unusually venomous things. But I have to admit, there was a little period after the election result came through where if I had had a cross, I might well have stabbed myself in the crotch with it, you know, a few times. Fortunately, there were none to hand. But there we go. So that's, dear listener, tick those off and just check whether you're demonically possessed or heading in that direction. So, Scott, it feels weird. We had a really bad result, but we also have to celebrate 1 year of the podcast, 52 episodes, and we're still going strong.
We are, and we will. And you know, come hell or high water, I think we'll still be doing this podcast for a while yet, won't we?
I think we will. I think we're. I think we're charging along. So
I'm having fun with it.
Yeah,
yes.
I am too. Yeah. So I promised the dear listener the story of my baptism. So we should get that out the road now.
Okay.
So, dear listener, I had a slightly unusual upbringing, but my mother wanted my brother and I to have to go to private schools because she wanted us to have the discipline of a private school and not be with the riffraff of government schools. So she was very keen for us to go to some sort of private school. And, of course, we were very poor working class. And actually, have I ever told you how working class we were, Scott? Did I mention my middle name? Should I give them? So, this is how middle class we were, dear listener. When my brother and I were born and names were being decided, well, my brother's older than me. His name is Glenn. And my mother said, well, what about a middle name? And my father said, no, my children are not having middle names. We're working class people and middle names are for posh people. So, so that's our middle class we were. Which ultimately turned out quite handy. As a solicitor, I used to have to sign and print my name on an enormous number of forms for people, and not having a middle name saved me and, you know, a lot of work. So for that, I ended up being quite grateful. But
yes,
you're getting the picture of a working class upbringing here. And my mother was keen for us to go to a private school. And the cheapest, you know, private schools, of course, were the Catholic schools. And we lived at Kangaroo Point, and there was a Catholic school, St. Joseph's at... we lived in Spring Hill and St. Joseph's was at Kangaroo Point. And so she sent us there and all was good, you know, Catholic nuns and typical little private Catholic convent school. And somewhere in about grade two, I think they were starting to think about confirmation or one of the religious ceremonies, and the nuns discovered that my brother and I had not been baptised. And yes, indeed. And so they said to my mother, well, you've got to get these boys baptized. And she said, well, I don't care whether they're baptized or not. If you want them baptized, you baptize them. So the nun said, oh, well, okay, and we'll baptize them here at the... Because the church was, you know, right next door to the school, like they shared the same grounds virtually, and and they said, so what about you know, godparents? And she said, well, I can't be bothered doing that, you find some godparents. So dear listener, I was in grade two, my brother's in grade three. One day at school we were hauled out of class, walked across to the church and baptized, and our godparents were a couple of grade 7 students. I sometimes wonder what my godparents think of what I've become, Scott.
Well, if they're like most godparents, they're probably as bad, if not worse, than what you are.
Possibly. So, you know, one day when I've got a lot of time on my hands and I'm retired or something, I'll have to go to the convent and look up who these people were and see if they're on Facebook or whatever and say, remember me? I'm your godson from that crazy day at St. Joseph's. And I've been heavily involved in the secular party and I'm plotting the downfall of religion. And you haven't... Let's see what they think. Are you enjoying the show and would you like to help out? There's a few easy things you can do. You can like us on Facebook and you can go onto iTunes and leave a positive review. That would be much appreciated. Also, if you're really keen, you could donate to us via Patreon. For details on how to do all this, visit our website. Thanks for your support. And now, back to the podcast. So, speaking of downfall of religion and plotting, we've discussed previously about the Connect religious materials in the Queensland school system, which is also used in other states, Scott. And
yes,
because I'm on the mailing list of YouthWorks, who are the publishers, they sent out an email saying that the Director of Christian Education Publications met with the Queensland Minister for Education, Kate Jones, and also in attendance were Auntie Jean, Senior Leader, Australian Aboriginal Church, along with Associate Professor of Law at Newcastle University, Neil Foster, and representatives of the Queensland Christian Instruction Network. And they've all converged on Kate Jones, the Education Minister, and no doubt given her an earful about our friend at the Windsor State School who stopped religious instruction lessons, Scott. Anyway, the media release, or the email, says that they're very confident that the Assistant Director General will be issuing a statement saying that it's business as usual for religious instruction in Queensland for the moment. So they've gone in there and harangued the minister and basically given a legal opinion saying what that principal did in Windsor is not on and blah, blah, blah. So be interesting to see how Kate Jones stands up to that sort of pressure from that group.
It will be interesting to see what happens. I mean, until I'd read that, I thought to myself that it's going to get canned.
Mm.
You know, that the whole thing will be finished. But maybe they will run it out, but I can't see it lasting beyond this year.
Mm. So let's keep an ear on that, or an eye on that. So, and then I've got a link to a very interesting article. Now, Ronnie Williams was the guy who ran the court cases in the High Court seeking to have the chaplaincy program struck out as being illegally funded. And he's done a post on a Facebook page and might read it next week in full. I'm not sure. It depends what comes up. But basically, giving the story... We've mentioned before how in Victoria the religious groups have been banned from entering the classroom, but they've got other sort of nefarious means of getting in where they call themselves counselling sessions or other sort of secular type names and get into the schools that way. And he tells a harrowing story about a girl who was at a government school and was offered, you know, whether she wanted to attend a SHINE program. The SHINE program has now been changed to Bella Girls. And they thought, oh, well, this sounds like some sort of innocuous self-improvement course to help girl's self-esteem and said, sure, why not? And then in the weeks following, they realized that this was a crazy Bible bashing exercise run by Lyle Shelton's sister, Letitia. And they get these girls and they take them to a camp and they brainwash them with all sorts of stuff. And it's a really harrowing and evil thing that they do, particularly with girls who might have suffered abuse, sexual or otherwise, from men. And a founding director of the Gold Coast Domestic Violence Prevention Centre talks about the camp and says, the Bella camp is so appalling. Taking vulnerable girls and re-traumatising them is outrageous. The potential for serious harm is concerning. Blah, blah, blah. So, shocking, appalling story, Scott, that one, that sounds awful the way that they've come in and said, oh, here's a self-esteem course, and meanwhile they're making girls feel re-traumatized and then using that to bring them into the church. Truly evil work by that group.
It is evil. And, you know, this line here summed up for me. The issue here was not the propriety of religious instructions, but the introduction by stealth.
Mm.
And that is, it is by stealth that they got these girls who were not... who were not really looking for anything religious, and they end up being pulled into it. You know, it's it really is evil. Yeah, I think you've hit the nail right on the head calling it evil.
Well worth a read if you're interested, dear listener. So there's a link to that. Scott, we're going to be faced with Malcolm Turnbull and Bill Shorten for a little while longer, so it's important that people know what their religious background is and where they stand.
Yeah,
because it determines how they're going to react to certain things. So a couple of articles here from the Bible Society. Malcolm Turnbull raised a Protestant, but in his 40s became a Catholic. So he admitted in his early days he was not particularly religious. By his early adulthood, he was a self-proclaimed agnostic. And he remained that way for almost three decades, well after his marriage to Lucy in 1980. But Lucy comes from an eminent Sydney family with close ties to the conservative Anglophile wing of the Catholic Church. And by virtue of that, it seems that he has switched over to the Catholic Church. So raised Protestant and ended up a Catholic, possibly largely because of Lucy. And this article simply makes the point, well, how Catholic is he? I mean, he's sort of neoliberal on economics, and that's not going to help the poor, and he's wanting to buy lots of submarines, and he's got a wait-and-see approach on global warming, so that's not very Christian, and his treatment of asylum seekers is not Christian. But on the other hand, many of his social issues of gambling, temperance, abortion, drugs, censorship, pornography, family law, etc. He seems to be a small L liberal, so kind of saying doesn't seem to be much of a Catholic would be what the upshot of that article would be, I think, Scott.
It would be, yeah.
Yep. And then same publication, being equal, they've done Bill Shorten, and Bill Shorten raised a Catholic and he became a Protestant.
Yes.
Just,
it was all arse about, wasn't it? You know.
Yeah. So his early influence in his life was his mother Anne, and throughout their childhood she took the kids to Mass every Sunday, and they attended Catholic school. Of course, Bill Shorten got married, but then he got divorced. And that's a problem in the Catholic Church. So,
it is, yeah.
So the thing is, if you're going to get remarried, you've got to find another alternative. That seems to be the crux of it, really, I think. He probably would have stayed a Catholic, I reckon, if he could have divorced
him. He got married in the Anglican Church, didn't he?
Mm. His second wife was Anglican, so yes.
Got married in the Anglican Church.
Yeah.
Essentially, the Anglican Church was set up by Henry VIII because the Roman Church wouldn't give him an annulment to his marriage.
There you go. Yep.
Yeah.
So, it's pathetic, isn't it? You know, you're a Catholic, and then, I need a divorce. I'll switch allegiance and I'll become an Anglican so I can get remarried. God. Sake. Scott, the UK has banned teaching of creationism in school that receives public funding.
And it's bloody brilliant, isn't it?
People would say we might have a hardcore sort of view on funding of schools because in the Secular Party... And I'll use that word while we're still called the Secular Party, but, you know, mightn't be for much longer. You know, we say that if obviously a government school should not have any creationism taught in it. They do, and we're saying they shouldn't. And even in private schools, we're saying, well, if you want government funding, you should not be teaching religious indoctrination. And lo and behold, in the UK, they've actually done that. So they've expanded the ban of teaching creationism from all state schools to all state schools as well as semi-private free schools and academies. The decision effectively means that no school in the United Kingdom can teach creationism or any other anti-scientific dogma without losing the entirety of its funding, as they would be violating the requirement of every academy and free school to provide a broad and balanced curriculum. I think that's absolutely fantastic, Scott.
It really is. And it's brilliant that they've done this. And what's even more brilliant is it's been done under a Conservative government. So, you know, this is not something that's done by the Labor Party, whether it's LABOUR or LABOR. It can be done by Conservatives. And... it is high time it was done, and, you know, there's bugger all to say about it except well done.
And people might think, well, we're not teaching creationism in Australian schools. Well, yes, we are, and it's happening in our state schools because I can walk to my bookshelf right now and get one of those evil Connect materials, and it's teaching creationism in there. So we are doing that. We're allowing it to happen, and... we need a law passed to say it shouldn't happen. So, oh, there you go, Scott. I mean, kind of questioning our motivation, the Secular Party, but you read things like that and you go, there's so much to do.
We've got a hell of a lot to do. We do have a hell of a lot that we've got to get done now and we've got to get it right. I'm very much in favour of that.
It's a matter of telling people, isn't it? Like, if you got people in a room and you said to them, well, you can vote for a party that's going to give you a few bike paths and maybe make a few bike racks on a train station. Or, on the other hand, there's an evil group teaching creationism in our schools and, you know, which is more important to you? Like, surely we could get more people who would go with the secular view as being the most important issue out of those two. Maybe not.
Well, you know, I mean, I was very heartened when Anne and I went up to the Mount Cravat markets, and that's in, you know, Mount Cravat's in the middle of the Bible Belt, ladies and gentlemen. You know, you've got Hillsong down the road, you've got, you've got a hell of a lot of Bibles out here. And one of the things that really got me heartened was you had one woman, she came up and she grabbed a leaflet and she read the back of it, and then she turned around and she said to me, it's scandalous they don't pay tax, isn't it?
Right.
You know, so that was one, you know.
Yes.
It was really very useful, yeah.
I had one guy tell me I was a bloody idiot. Actually, he used words more offensive than that, but...
oh, really?
Yeah, I did, yeah. Scott, because we've done such a big election review, we've got a host of things which can probably all hang over till next week, I think. But one that I'm interested in talking about next week will be the UK is going to come out with the results of an inquiry into the Iraq War and Tony Blair's involvement.
And that's coming out this week, isn't it?
I'm looking forward to that. So, and maybe people will question our involvement as well in Australia.
Well, we'll have to see what the result is from London, but I would have thought that if their inquiry, as the name escapes me, if it's critical of Britain's involvement, it's got to be critical of Australia's involvement too. So, yeah, it's it really is very... What's the word I'm looking for? It really is very heartening that it's been done, and we'll have to see where it goes. But I think it will be very useful to hear.
Well, dear listener, I think we've reached our tick over an hour mark. So apologies if we're a little bit down at the beginning. Sorry if it was a little bit too much sort of post-election review. But, you know, it is what it is. And, hey, you got the baptism story and you got a, you got the middle name story as well as a bonus. So hopefully that cheered you up a bit. And we, over the next week, will lick our wounds and decide what we're doing. And fear not, the podcast, whatever happens, Scott, this podcast is, we're going to keep this going until we're...
I think we're going to keep it going for a long time,
I think so.
I have fun with it every Wednesday night.
That is good. All right, dear listener, thank you for your attention. We will catch up with you next week.
Yes, talk to you then. Bye now.
Goodbye. Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time, and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast, and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf on their phone and just put the word out. The other thing is you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon, and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It just, it'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation, so you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners, and that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.